Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Coming up on Chopper's Politics.
I find it amazing that a Conservative Unionist Party Prime Minister doesn't understand what it means to be part of the union. I mean, I would have thought that being part of the union was fairly clear-cut.
Hello, I'm Christopher Hope, the Associate Editor for Politics at The Telegraph, and this is Chopper's Politics podcast. Now, Boris Johnson might have left Number 10, but he's never far away from British politics and the front line. The problems left over from his removal by MPs last year remain. The Tory grassroots are still, by and large, furious about it. And they are now starting to move against MPs they blame. More on that later. And Johnson's been busy in Parliament too, pushing for a more robust response from the UK in Ukraine's war against the Russian invaders. More on the future of that conflict, which started a year ago today, later too. But first, Brexit. Yep, Brexit and Boris Johnson's deal in Northern Ireland. Rishi Sunak is in a bind about what to do next to resolve the impasse, where the DUP is unimpressed by his efforts. Now, the PM met with the DUP last Thursday in Belfast, and by all accounts, it didn't go well. With me now is Sammy Wilson, the DUP's Brexit spokesman.
Thank you very much for the invite, Chris.
Not at all. Now, whenever you're on the podcast, it means Brexit's a problem. So what happened last Thursday?
Well, out of the blue, and it really was out of the blue, we were told the Prime Minister was coming to Northern Ireland for meetings with the parties on Friday. Late on Thursday evening, then the Prime Minister requested that he meet a delegation from the party. I wasn't able to go. I think it was about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, actually, in the evening.
Right.
And the four went, who happened to be close to the hotel and were available, went along with Geoffrey Donaldson, and they met with the Prime Minister. And us, from all of the accounts I've been given, it wasn't the most pleasant of meetings. And it seemed that the Prime Minister had come with a package which he expected us to adhere to, and then get back into Stormont, just like that. And, you know, there's been no pre-discussion about what was being talked about. And I can understand that, you know, when you're in the middle of negotiations, you don't want to divulge what's happening in negotiations until they're completed. Though the Prime Minister does know, and Downing Street would know, that on occasions when we have been given information in confidence and asked not to spread it, we have adhered to that. We have never, ever broken a confidence. And I would have thought that the right thing to have done would have been at least at some stage during the negotiations to give some indication of the direction of them, the content of them, to see if it was even coming close to what we required to get back into Stormont.
Those seven tests the DUP have set guarantee the sixth article of the Act of Union 1800, avoid diversion of trade, no border in the Irish Sea, giving Northern Ireland people a say in their laws, no checks on goods between GB and NI, and no regulatory barriers unless agreed by Stormont, and preserving the letter and spirit of Northern Ireland's position set out in the Good Friday Agreement. Of those seven, how many do you think were ticked by what Mr. Sunak offered you last Thursday?
Well, I think that's probably the wrong approach to looking at those tests.
Okay.
Those tests set the background to how we will judge any deal. And many of them are interlinked anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, ensuring that the laws that are passed in Northern Ireland are passed with the assent of the people of Northern Ireland. That, of course, would ensure that you don't, because we're not going to vote for regulatory barriers, we're not going to vote for a border in the Irish Sea, we're not going to adhere to any laws which cause trade to be restricted, etc. So I think rather than say which have been ticked, it's better to ask, has the central premise of all of those tests been addressed? And the answer is, quite clearly, in our eyes, from what we know of the deal so far, is that it hasn't, because Northern Ireland will still be under EU law. The very fact is the Prime Minister has admitted there'll be some role for the European Court of Justice. Why would there be a role for the European Court of Justice if there was no EU law applying in Northern Ireland?
That seems to me the absolute red line on the whole thing. If he can deal with the issue of ECJ jurisdiction over Northern Ireland, then he would then, I think, go a long way to getting you to agree.
He would. I mean, we have made it quite clear that we are unionists. We believe that we should be fully part of the United Kingdom, not partially. And that means that British law has to apply to this part of the United Kingdom, not Brussels law. And once you deal with that, then you deal with all of the other issues anyway about trade barriers.
I was trying to explain to somebody, and I don't want to sound offensive, but in the same way that we understand what the SNP mean by Scottish independence, there seems to be a problem in understanding what the DUP mean by the union. Do you know what I mean? It seems to be a sort of barrier to understanding that.
I find it amazing that a Conservative Unionist Party Prime Minister doesn't understand what it means to be part of the union. I mean, I would have thought that being part of the union was fairly clear-cut, that being part of the union means that you've got constitutional links and you've got economic links. And that, of course, is what the Article 6 of the Act of Union made clear, that being part of the United Kingdom meant that trade could freely exchange across all of the United Kingdom, so people would not only have the constitutional umbrella that you were part of a nation and you acted as part of that nation and the laws of that nation applied to you, but also you would have the benefits of the economic benefits of that nation.
Do you think Rishi Sunak is actually a Brexiteer?
Well, you know, he stuck his neck out at a time when it wasn't popular. He made it clear that he believed that we were better free of Europe. But I think, like all politicians in the Conservative Party who have seen, they have balked at taking on the European Union when it has resisted Brexit. And I think that's a big problem, that until people get into their minds and politicians in the government get it in their mindset that, look, we have left the European Union, our duty is no longer to the European Union, it's to the United Kingdom, then we're always going to have this quandary. I mean, let me give you one example of this, Chris. The number of British politicians I have heard talk about, oh, we've got to be careful, we don't upset and we don't intrude upon and we don't disturb and we don't destroy the European single market. And to do that, they're prepared to destroy the UK single market. I just don't understand that mentality. And that's why I think that even people who, like the Chancellor or the Prime Minister, who claim to be a Brexiteer, still seems to have this belief that they've got some obligation to the EU and that obligation actually supersedes their obligation to the United Kingdom.
It just seems so reminiscent, doesn't it, of Theresa May. It's almost like a Theresa May 2.0 strategy to leave you guys in the dark when you're so important, because if you give the green light to it, most of the Brexiteers I speak to will fall in behind. I mean, they're really waiting on what you think. You're the canary in the mine for them. If you're happy, then they're happy.
And I think that they've also, at least they tell us, they've conveyed that to the Prime Minister as well. But they've said it publicly too. Mm. They've said it, I've heard it said in the Chamber in the House of Commons. They have said it in radio interviews that I've heard. And they've said it to our face as well. We're not going to try to be more unionist than you are. So the Prime Minister could do away with any dissent within his own party by simply getting a deal which honours his commitment as a unionist to the union, which delivers on the promise which he made in the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, and which gets rid of the problem of the executive not working in Northern Ireland and the dissent within his own party.
It involves being political, and I'm not sure he's got really much of a political bone in his body. That's the concern from a lot of Tory MPs I speak to. Can I ask you, has Boris Johnson been in touch? Is he helping behind the scenes?
Well, Boris Johnson has certainly helped, I think, last week by demanding and saying that he believes a protocol bill should be pushed through the House of Lords to give the government that extra bit of leverage in negotiations. And yes, I understand that he has had conversations both with members of the ERG, which have been conveyed to us, and I think with Geoffrey Donaldson, that he wants to help. And I've got to be quite frank with you, Chris. I think he's got a duty to help, because after all, he was the person who got us into the situation we're in at present.
Absolutely. And what kind of support is that? What's he doing? Is he saying he'll do a speech or say something or support?
Well, he's already done something, and he's written in your own paper indicating, as we have been, you know, it's not that we're following him, he's actually following us.
So he's trying to help resolve an issue which, of course, dates back to his time as Prime Minister.
It does, yes, and which he believes is work which now needs to be completed. And I think this call, for example, for the protocol bill to be finalised and got through as a means of presenting the EU with, well, we've got an alternative here, by the way. We can act unilaterally, and we've got Parliament to approve us acting unilaterally. I think that that's been a very helpful intervention. Not that I think that the Prime Minister intends to take that advice at the moment.
Sammy, just going back finally to the Boris Johnson point, is he held, how many meetings has he had with Geoffrey?
I don't think he's had any meetings with him. I think that he has sent messages that he wants to give his support. But Chris, again, I don't want to be made a liar of here. There may have been meetings, but I am not aware of any meetings, and certainly none have been conveyed to us.
In your world, Sammy, if you were the Prime Minister, what would replace ECJ oversight between the EU and UK trading? Would it be some form of special committee or something else?
No, I mean, first of all, I think that ECJ oversight is predicated on the fact that EU law still applies in Northern Ireland. So if you deal with that issue and make it quite clear to the EU, look, Northern Ireland is not remaining partially in the single market. It will not be taking single market rules. It will be taking the rules which either the Northern Ireland Assembly applies because those issues are devolved, or the UK government applies because those issues are retained at Westminster. That's the first thing. And that would do away with any role for the ECJ. And when it comes to any trade disputes that might be as a result of Northern Ireland sending goods into the Irish Republic, well, the same mechanism is being used for trade disputes between the whole of the United Kingdom and the EU would be used.
Do you worry, though, that the Tories might be your last chance to get a deal that may be even in a ballpark working for you? Because the EU could just wait. The waiting game is on their side, because they can see what may happen next year with an election. They can see Keir Starmer might come on board as Prime Minister, and they've got a better chance of doing some kind of closer alignment deal with him, which disregards your concerns in a sense that the Tories can't afford to.
Well, a bad deal done by the Conservative Party or a bad deal done by the Labour Party is going to make no difference in Northern Ireland.
Yep.
The same effects. Obviously, we believe that, in theory anyhow, the party which is mostly closely associated with Brexit should be able to deliver a better deal for Northern Ireland than the Labour Party. But we haven't had any evidence of that. Don't forget, we're in the position we are because the Conservatives delivered a very bad deal for Northern Ireland and simply dispensed with us to try and get a deal through. And for 3 years now, I have not tried to rectify that.
Nope.
But, you know, Chris, at the end of the day, we have not had the Conservative Party dealing fairly with Northern Ireland. And as I say to you, a bad deal, regardless of who delivers it, still is a bad deal.
There are reports that Rishi Sunak might be in town next week, trying to get some deal agreed next week. Have you heard that?
Well, there's been rumours that they're still going to push ahead and try and get this deal through as quickly as possible. But, you know, he now knows that within his own party, there are people who are not prepared to accept a deal which falls short of. And it's not, Chris, I just say this to you. This is not an unreasonable demand that we are making. that before we go back into the Assembly in Northern Ireland, where we will be required to implement whatever deal is done with the EU, that there's an assurance given to us and there's a deal done which does not require us to implement laws and implement arrangements which we believe are designed for further separation from the United Kingdom and also further economic damage to Northern Ireland. It's not unreasonable for us to ask for that. And if the Prime Minister is not in a position next week to bring forward proposals to that effect, then he shouldn't really be pursuing it. He should be going back to the EU. And the first thing he should be doing, in my view, is strengthening his own hand by pushing the protocol bill through the House of Lords, having an alternative and a backup if the EU are not prepared to show the flexibility that is required. And also, of course, he's got the leverage of the Good Friday Agreement not working because it can't work whilst the protocol is in place. As the late David Trimble said, you've got one of two alternatives. A Good Friday Agreement and protocol can't live together. Either you rip up the Good Friday Agreement and keep the protocol intact, or you rip up the protocol and keep the Good Friday Agreement intact.
Yeah, and the latter is obviously preferable.
Well, the latter is necessary.
Yeah, quite necessary.
Because don't forget, the structures of the Good Friday Agreement and its existence was what was give us the delicate political balance in Northern Ireland to enable two communities to work together.
Just finally, Sammy Wilson, thank you for joining us this week. What are the odds on a deal which you think is acceptable this year? I mean, do you see this going on for months and months and months?
Well, that really depends upon the mindset of the government. I honestly do believe that if a government were to go in to negotiations with an alternative available and with a determination to push the EU to remove a requirement which they don't require for any other country that trades with them, then there's a chance of success. If he goes in mealy-mouthed, cautious, afraid of disturbing the EU too much in case they started a trade war with us, then I don't see there's any chance next week or next month or this year.
Well, Sammy Wilson, the Brexit spokesman for the DUP, thank you for joining us this week on Chopper's Politics Podcast. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sammy Wilson there. Now, coming up after the break, the Tory grassroots are revolting. Yep, they're pretty cross, and Tory MPs should be worried. Right after this.
If you're finding this podcast interesting, you may also like Ukraine, the Latest. Every weekday, The Telegraph's leading journalists bring you the latest news and the most informed analysis of President Putin's invasion of Ukraine. From our newsroom in London and from the ground.
The Russian machine has been ground to a halt now for well over a week, and that is just staggering.
NATO has to act now. It has to do more than it's currently doing. Otherwise, in this Ukrainian MP's words, you'll have to evacuate the whole continent.
One video that we found to be incorrect was bomb squads seen in the Donbass region. The metadata of this clip shows that it was created in 2019, not today.
Search Ukraine, the Latest, in the same place you're listening to this, and click follow so you don't miss an update.
And we're back. Now, Tory MPs have until mid-July to be reselected as candidates at the next election after the recent shake-up in constituency boundaries. And for some, it's not going well, with Damien Green, the former de facto Deputy Prime Minister for Theresa May's government, the latest not to be selected for a new seat. Some see this as revenge over Boris Johnson's defenestration. But is that right? With me now is David Campbell Bannerman, the chairman of the Conservative Democratic Organisation, which campaigns for a bigger voice for Tory members in their party. David Campbell Bannerman, welcome to Chopper's Politics.
Thank you, Chopper. It's great to be here.
Now, there's a big campaign called BBB, hashtag BBB, Bring Back Boris. Are you aware of this campaign?
Yes, I am. Yes.
You're a big supporter of Boris Johnson.
I am. Yeah.
Was that campaign anything to do with the reason why former de facto Deputy Prime Minister Damien Green was rejected as a Tory candidate for Weald of Kent at the weekend?
Well, it was one of a number of factors. I understand the main factor was about democracy, that the new local association, because it was, it's reformed.
That's right. He was Ashford MP, and he's trying to move into a nearby
seat.
Yeah,
it's the new seat, Weald of Kent, it's to be called, and he's moving from Ashford, yes. I mean, it's the selection committee, technically, or selection council, decided they wanted a fresh choice. They didn't want to be dictated to by central office. Mm. So it was a reaction to that. But one of the other criteria was there were people who felt that Damien Green particularly had been out to do down Boris. Mm. And that was a factor. It wasn't the main factor, but it was a factor.
I think that's disputed by Mr Green himself, but I know that's been reported that way.
Well, I can tell you, we know people in the room.
Yeah. And, so do you think this eruption against Damien Green, a respected former cabinet minister, is evidence of discontent amongst the grassroots still about the way Boris Johnson was treated, about the way they've been cut out from the appointment of Mr. Sunak as Prime Minister?
Yeah, I should say straight away, Chopper, that, I think Damien Green's a nice guy, and I there's nothing personal against him. I think he's done well on immigration and law and order. But, I'm chairman of the Conservative Democratic Organisation. We believe members have the right to make the choice. They obviously felt disgruntled about being told what to do by central office, and they made their own choices. But yes, it is coming out of discontent. There's a whole well of discontent in the party at the moment. You have a prime minister in Rishi Sunak that was rejected, 40-60 was the vote against Liz Truss. And then 2 months later, he was kind of anointed or appointed. And members feel they never got a proper say on it.
Well, they didn't.
They didn't. I mean, technically, they didn't.
They didn't feel it. They didn't.
They didn't. And that, it was the kind of the arrogance of that decision. And it was always the case. They wanted to bring down Boris, and they had the numbers, and they wanted to bring down Truss, and again, they had the numbers.
That's MPs.
MPs, that is, yeah. This is really a reaction to MPs. They're being held to account for, plunging the party into crisis. Yeah. I mean, the polls are -27% today. When Boris resigned in his resignation speech, you can see, the polls are only -2%. It was somewhere between 2 and 4%. But, we've really gone down badly due to the chaos. And you can, point fingers at Liz Truss. But Liz Truss would not have been there if they had kept Boris. And Rishi wouldn't be there if they had kept Boris.
And it's all about Boris. It's all about bringing him back. Is that what the idea is? Is this part of a move to try and find MPs who are acceptable to a Boris Johnson-led party?
Well, CDO that I chair, and Lord Cruddas is president, we're not about bring back Boris, actually. We're about empowering the membership and about party democracy. And that's very genuine. I mean, I worked as patron of the Campaign for Conservative Democracy for 6 years with John Strafford, who actually helped write the 1998 Constitution.
Yes.
The Conservative Party didn't exist legally before 1998. People don't realise that. So this has been a long campaign, and CDO is the latest variant of it. But I would say, having said that, if the members want Boris to come back and there's a strong case for it, then we respect the view of the members.
And that should be at the heart of how the party's run. What do the members want? It's their party.
Yeah, it would be a nice, refreshing change. Well, you see, what's happening with the membership? It's collapsed since 98. It was about 500,000 in 98 under Hague's wonderful constitution. And it collapsed about 150,000 at the moment, we reckon. And why has that happened? Well, what do you get for your membership? And they're going to put up the fee, by the way, 60% to £39. I mean, you can't choose your candidate as an MP. You get a choice of three now, not 300, as they used to.
Given to you by the...
By Central Office. And I tell you the way it works. You've got a favoured candidate, often an ex-special advisor or a current special advisor. And then you've got two selected wingmen. Who, tick boxes. To be honest, let's be honest, this is the ruthless way they operate. And a choice of three is unacceptable. If you can't choose a leader, as we've seen with Sunak, and you're not being listened to on policies, and we think the Spring Forum, which is about to take place in March, should be a policy conference. Ministers should be there to listen, not talk. So that, you know, you can actually make membership far more attractive than it is at
the moment. Well, right now, the Labour Party is open to policy ideas until March the 17th, and that's a policy forum. They'll be then looked at, read by an MP-chaired group, and then one imagines that is fed into the manifesto. I mean, that's the idea. Called democracy, maybe.
It is called democracy. I mean, we're not arguing for, you know, people call us the Tory momentum. We're not Tory momentum. We don't actually stand on the basis of policies like the Labour momentum do. But what we are about is empowering the members. And the members think democratically that, you know, immigration control is not being properly considered. Then that should feed through.
Do you think Central Office doesn't like members? Are they annoying?
No, I don't think that. I've heard... often secondhand, but from quite senior people that, you know, the membership is a pain, let's get rid of the membership, actually from very senior people saying this. And it's outrageous, you know, democracy. I do believe in democracy. We're doing this for democratic reasons. I was involved with Brexit, which again was actually about democracy and about people having a choice. The members aren't stupid. You know, many are professionals, teachers, you know, hard workers, taxi drivers, you know, they represent the working people of local areas around the country, and they should be allowed to choose their own candidates.
They're taken for granted?
Yes, they are. They're shown contempt, in my view. All they hear from central office is give us money or hand out some leaflets. That's all they're interested in. They don't want to know about their policy thoughts. They don't know what their opinion on candidates are. You've been given three, and this is the favoured candidate. Mm. And, you know, you've got organisations like Women to Win, you know, which is supposedly a sort of semi-affiliated with the party, who are doing their own thing. And Theresa May started out, and Anne Jenkin. And to be honest, you know, we do want good candidates, good female candidates, but on what basis? We don't have to fix the system.
No, you want the best candidates, I imagine, at the party. But so there's a reckoning, do you think, taking place here?
Yeah, I get the feel of a reckoning.
Of MPs...
Yeah, MPs being held to account.
Johnson,
yeah,
I mean,
because
the rest of it.
MPs have caused this chaos by bringing down Boris. There were about 60 MPs who signed letters or resigned or said Boris should go. There's more than that, maybe 100, 150 that didn't want Boris. But the point is, you know, I'm not saying Boris was flawless. He certainly wasn't. But, you know, look at the disaster that has followed getting rid of him. Surely they should have toughed it out. Well, you know, got him to improve performance.
I mean, nowadays, you know, my view might be, is it right that a party can remove a democratically elected Prime Minister? I know you elect an MP who elect their own ministers and MPs, but in a sense, that's where we are, really. It almost offends against that.
He won an 80-seat majority. It was the biggest majority since 1987 under Thatcher, against the run of mill in many ways. And like the Red Wall seats are all down to Boris, in my view, because I saw his appeal in London. I helped him on the London campaign. And he's a bit like Heineken. He extends to parts that other politicians don't reach. He is remarkable. And those are often Labour and Lib Dems. And I was speaking to Labour and Lib Dems exclusively, my whole team was, when we're helping him in the mayoral elections.
So what's next then? There's a reckoning. Do you think as many as 150 MPs might be removed by members in the next few months? What's your forecast?
We don't have a hit list or a target list. We're not operating like that. But we support members, and I think we've empowered members to take back control, to say, hang on, this isn't good enough. We're not getting a good enough choice here. We want to do it our way. We want more choice. So I think, though, that a lot of these MPs will be coming up for selection and they will be held to account. And if they brought down Boris, and there's, you know, a lot of the membership still, 56% arguably, are still very pro-Boris and they're very sore.
So how many more? You think dozens might be told they can't stand again?
I think there'll be some more deselections coming. Yes, potentially, yes. As I say, I'm not advocating it, but what I'm advocating is the members have the right and the power to do this. And, you know, central office should back off and they should be allowed to make their decisions. I mean, at the end of the day, before 98, associations chose their MP. And, you know, that's the way it worked. It wasn't central office doing it, and they've got far too much control.
There's a way out of this mess, isn't there? Which is basically give more power back to the members who fund the party.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when Boris came in as leader, membership shot up. And, you know, CDO has been hard at work keeping thousands going to Reform. the Reform Party, and there's hard evidence in all the emails we get, you know, give us a second chance with CDO. I say, look, let's have a true party, not a new party, because Reform, by the way, doesn't have any members. It's just one man, and they just have supporters. So it's not,
to put pressure
not democratic.
On the Tory party to adopt arguably right-wing Tory policies.
Yeah, but, you know, the members of the Conservative Party, if that's what they wish and we want to see ways of expressing that, then, you know, that can be done with CDO within the party.
Well, David Campbell Bannerman, thank you for joining us this week on Chopper's Politics Podcast. Thank you.
Real pleasure. Thanks.
David Campbell Bannerman there. A year ago, Russia invaded Ukraine and the conflict has not gone as Vladimir Putin wanted. I'm joined now by Tobias Elwood, the chairman of the Defence Select Committee in the House of Commons. And I started by asking him the only question that matters. How will this war end?
Well, that is the big question. I mean, first, congratulations to Britain for pushing the envelope on what we should do in response to Ukraine. But I have to say it's been pretty timid. A year after the invasion, only now are we looking at serious hardware, main battle tanks being slid across the table to Ukraine. We just had this big Munich Security Conference, the biggest of its kind in Europe, where, of course, Ukraine dominated. But three big questions came up. Firstly, we require greater military assistance. What form is that going to take? Lots of talk about air power, you know, fast jets, which perhaps we'll discuss. Second point is Putin is clearly in this for the long haul. He is now a spoiler power, and he is determined to see this through. He's hoping to test the will of the West, that we will lose that political appetite, that willingness to support Ukraine. And finally, the bigger question, more concerning, is that this isn't just about Ukraine. This is about Russia redefining what the whole of Europe looks like and an alliance that's growing between Russia and China.
We'll come on to those parts later. What is a spoiler power?
A spoiler power is one that no longer is willing to participate in the international rules-based order. Quite the opposite, is willing to take advantage of its wobbliness, its weakness, and so forth. I mean, really curious that from the Security Council, supposed to be that arbiter to keep the peace across the world, one P5 nation, permanent member, attacks a state. Another P5 nation, China, doesn't declare it, you know, wrong in any form whatsoever. And the other three P5 members, Britain, France, the United States, can't agree on what collectively we should do to put that fire out. Now, that's a worrying state of affairs for the international community.
Where does it go from here, there? You say there that you think that Putin is willing to fight to the end. I mean, he's running out of stuff, isn't he? That's the point. I mean, he's being squeezed by sanctions.
Yeah,
he's expending munitions on the battlefield.
Absolutely right. But don't, you know, be deterred by this. His ability to retool industries, his ability to just recruit more people and throw them to the front line. You know, I believe it's a myth that somehow he's not able to have the support of his own people. Don't forget, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy collapsed. Who was the great savior that moved the country forward? It was Putin. He's still seen as a hero.
What's the policy, do you think, in Whitehall? What is the MOD doing? Are they hoping there'll be an uprising of generals against Putin to overthrow him? Is that what's going on?
You know, that's for the birds. That really is, because Putin has actually included everybody that there is. There is no person that's not touched in some way, not connected in this some way to what Putin is doing. But the Russia's ability to endure hardship, and that's been proved over centuries, far greater than ours. Once we start losing losses on the battlefield and it's on the front pages of papers like yourselves, then politicians sort of change their mind. So Russia is in there for the duration.
And that's through this year. There's talk of a peace conference at the end of the year after some dreadful fighting this year.
And who's calling for that peace conference? It's China, which shows where China sits on this. China and Russia are increasingly more greatly aligned. And that's happened even more so since the invasion itself. China is saying, let's sit down and talk. That allows the bully to have taken three steps forward, one step back, and then retain ownership of a chunk of Ukraine.
Where do you see the alliance weakening most? Do you think America is the weakness in this whole effort to support Vladimir Zelensky?
Well, I think you need the American leadership. That's absolutely right. They're the biggest members.
But on left and right now, there are voices off, aren't there?
You're right. In the domestic piece, it is the Republican Party that's concerned about that. All the more reason why we need to, you know, clear this up very, very quickly indeed, because as I said, Putin will drag this out. Frozen conflict suits him. I'm pleased that President Biden went to Ukraine, heard
by train from Poland.
My goodness. I mean, how about that? Taking their risk. I understand that the Americans did let Russia know to say, you know, this is happening, don't you dare, otherwise you could trigger something much, much larger, which you won't be able to handle. But what we've got at the moment is perhaps a lack of a plan, a lack of clarity. You know, if I ask anybody, what does a mission success look like? Mm. It's not clear.
Is it Crimea?
For me, it is very, very clear.
So Russia is
liberation
out
of Donbass, the east of Ukraine, liberation of the Crimea, a sovereign Ukraine. Anything less than that, and the bully is seen to succeed.
And is that shared by MOD, by Ben Wallace?
Well, they won't say it. They give us this answer, which sort of distances themselves from any responsibility by saying, oh, it's for Ukraine to decide. No, the cost of living crisis in the UK is a consequence to what's going on in Ukraine. The reason why energy prices are up is because of Ukraine. It's in our interest as well to see this out and quickly. And I have to say, it's in our DNA, as we've shown a couple of times in the last century, to step forward when others perhaps don't. And I want to see more of that from
fair,
our government.
That is what the government's done. I mean, Boris Johnson led the moves against the invasion last year, didn't he? I mean, he has been, and Rishi Sunak, to his credit, has done the similar work.
Yes, that's true. Although I have to say that on the the domestic side, Boris Johnson cut back on the number of tanks and aeroplanes and ships and so forth. So it's important now that we focus less on the tactics, the military assistance that you're talking about, and what is the strategy? Let's get that port opened in Odessa. Let's get the actual grain heading out. Let's provide the top cover that's going to allow Ukraine to punch through the Russian defences. And then they seem to gain terrain, and that will keep the West supporting.
Okay, so on top cover, you mean fast jets?
Exactly.
That's what you mean?
We immediately assume, because it's easy language for us to say fast jets, it needs to be air power. Which
air
comes
power,
in
drones, satellite support.
Exactly. Comes in many forms.
When will that happen? And if so, when?
Well, it needs to happen. We need to put in Ukrainian cadets into our flight schools. Let's do that now. But it takes 3 years to get a pilot out there. But there are other forms of air power. The A-10 Thunderbolt, for example, the Super Tucano. There are longer-range missiles, drones that you mentioned as well. This can provide the tanks the top cover they need. It's a bit like when you're playing Risk. It's giving you another dice to play with to be able to give you more possibility.
And when will that happen, do you think, as someone who's plugged totally into this process far more than most people?
What my concern is, going back to the Munich Security Conference, that everybody is now aware.
Is it weeks or months away to pass over?
That's the problem. It's not
what is it?
Straight
what do you
away.
Think?
Well, it's, at the moment, it's months away. How long did it take us to get tanks slid across the line? And we're having the same hesitant discussion about
where's
this because
problem?
We're spooked by Putin's
right,
rhetoric.
Where's the problem? Is it Jens Stoltenberg? Is the NATO end? Is it UK, so US alliance? Is it Germany and France?
Let's put NATO in perspective. It means well, but it's a consensus-driven organisation. And as long as you've got Turkey and Hungary saying no thank you, then that can't move forward. There's another organisation, slightly smaller, called the Joint Expeditionary Force, something we created. All them NATO countries, 10 of them in the east of Europe, I would like to see Poland and Ukraine join that, and that can provide this important alliance that Ukraine can then depend upon in the longer term. They're not going to be joining NATO anytime soon. And an example of that is the fact that Finland and Sweden are still waiting for their membership. Why? Because it's been delayed by Hungary and Turkey.
That's coming soon, though, isn't it? But you wrote in the Telegraph this week about how this is the start of a new Cold War with Russia.
Absolutely.
What do you
right.
mean by that?
It's not just a Cold War with Russia. It's a Cold War with Russia and China.
And what do you mean by that?
It's simply because the, as I was touching on, the P5 nations, the United Nations, can no longer act as the arbiters of global peace. They're exploiting how poor the actual international rules-based order, as we're calling, is working, to their own advantage. Want a weaker West.
A Cold War implies Iron Curtain. It implies that we kind of put up a wall around these countries.
Well, it won't be the same as the last one, which was a build-up of military might either side of an Iron Curtain. It won't be operating that way. It'll be an economic war where there'll be rules that Russia and China abide by, countries then having to choose who they operate to. Our world will splinter into two spheres of dangerously competing influence. And we are too timid in the West to be strong about what we believe in, what our purpose is, what we stand for. And that's allowed us, I'm afraid, Russia to then take advantage of that. Afghanistan is the biggest example, how we gave up there in actually supporting a democracy.
Do you draw a line between the chaos ending of a US and Afghanistan and the invasion of Ukraine a year ago?
There's an absolute direct line, completely.
That Putin saw weakness and then thought, right, I'm going to do something for my own interests now and invade Ukraine.
He saw that we didn't have the strategic patience and courage to stick with it and realised that we were also unified, take America out of there, and you can see what Putin is banking on. He wants Trump to come back. He's hoping that there'll be more populist governments around the world, that the West will not be united. And this is what's so sad, is that there is strategic strength in us working collectively together. The G10 nations, for example, That's half the world's GDP. We should be able to stand up to both Russia and China.
But that has happened, no. Marcel. You're painting quite a gloomy picture. It is happening that...
Where's this happening?
Well, the West is standing up to support Zelensky.
Tell me which British companies can operate in China in the same way that Chinese companies can operate here. They're not allowed to.
But they're prescribing oligarchs here, aren't they? And they're,
of course.
This is on the Russian side.
Is that affecting the agenda of Putin? Nothing that we do is changing what Putin does.
Limits on oil and gas price acquisitions from Russia.
And this is where there's a symbiotic relationship between Russia and China. Russia's got a lot of oil and gas. China needs it. So they're working together. And China reciprocates with the complex weapon systems, particularly in the microchips, that Russia needs to continue this war. That's the concern I have. We need to rekindle that Cold War statecraft, be able to stand up to Putin. It all goes back to Ukraine. Put this fire out and we can actually start to rebuild what the West stands for.
So as things stand, if nothing further escalation happens in terms of air power, when does the war end? Is it years away, do you think?
It's going to be. It'll drag into a frozen conflict, which will then allow Putin to stay because nobody will then get rid of him. And then what will happen is it'll all die down. And guess what? In a couple of years' time, it'll flare up all over again.
So it's years and years and years.
Unless we do something about it. Unless we have the political courage to do something about it.
Well, Tobias Elwood, the chairman of the Defence Select Committee in House of Commons, thank you for joining us this week on Chopper's Politics Podcast with a sobering warning there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tobias Elwood there. Now, if you found my discussion with Tobias Elwood interesting, you may enjoy another Telegraph podcast. It's called Ukraine the Latest, with all of the Telegraph's top reporters giving you daily updates on the conflict from here and on the ground in Ukraine. You can find it wherever you get this podcast, and I'll put a link for it in the show notes of this episode. Well, that's all for this week, listeners. Thank you to my guests, Sammy Wilson, MP, Tobias Elwood, MP, and of course, David Campbell Bannerman. Let me know what your thoughts are about what they had to say by emailing me, chopperspolitics@telegraph.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're @chopperspodcast. Thank you to my brilliant team of producers, Louisa Wells and Giles Gear, but most importantly of all, thank you to you for listening. For more insights into the turbulent political sphere, why not sign up to my daily Choppers Politics newsletter? The link for that will be in the show notes of this episode. Don't forget my weekly Peterborough Diary gossip column, out on Fridays at 7 p.m. online and in Saturday's copy of the Daily Telegraph. And always do buy a copy of the Telegraph if you can. I know you won't regret it. Until next time, though, cheerio!
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.